Before 1956, if you were going to ship goods, they had to be loaded onto a rail car, truck, or ship, essentially by hand, an incredibly labor-intensive and expensive process. If you were shipping by sea, the process went something like this. At the shipper's factory or warehouse, freight would be loaded piece by piece onto a truck or rail car. They would then deliver these hundreds or thousands of items to the waterfront, where each was unloaded separately, recorded on a tally sheet, and carried to a warehouse. When the ship was ready to load, the process was reversed. It was kind of like when you move houses and everything is packed, loaded, and unloaded by hand. This work was physically demanding, as longshoremen carried goods into the cargo hold. 80-pound stems of bananas were walked down the gangplank. Coffee came in 120-pound bags. Reloading the ship could not take place until every bit of cargo had been unloaded. The work was highly irregular. One day, the urgent need to unload perishable cargo would create sudden jobs, with little work the following day. Malcolm Purcell McLean, who owned a North Carolina trucking company, was well aware of how expensive shipping was, and he tried to come up with a solution. His ideas included having ramps where men could drive delivery trucks onto the ship and then deposit their trailers. This morphed into having just the trailer bodies, but those had to be manufactured. Small steel boxes were available, but they were generally too small to be practical. Truck trailer bodies were also available, but they were too heavy. McLean contacted Spokane resident Keith Tatlinger, who had a reputation as a container expert. Tatlinger designed a 30-foot aluminum box that could be stacked too high on ships going up and down the Atlantic seaboard and on the barges operating between Seattle and Alaska. After the ship reached its destination, they were easily placed on a chassis pulled by a truck. This invention of the shipping container reorganized the world's economy. At a local level, factories and warehouses moved farther from the docks as transportation costs dropped. Without the need for people to physically move goods, the numbers of longshoremen also dropped, in some places by 90%. And since distance between producer and consumer was essentially no longer a factor, many companies moved their operations abroad where labor costs were cheaper. The development of container ports, who could afford them and where they were located, also had consequences. The cheapness of shipping and the global shift in manufacturing to Asia caused a boom in port construction on the West Coast. Seattle, Oakland, Los Angeles, and Long Beach were the winners in this contest, and older ports like Portland declined. In the 1950s, Portland handled nearly as much cargo as Seattle, but couldn't muster the money or resources to build a container port. The consequences were dramatic. Seattle's foreign trade doubled between 1963 and 1972, while Portland's barely grew. The global trade network that we have today is largely thanks to Tatlinger's containers, but there are some substantial drawbacks. The increasingly large size of ships means that they stretch existing transportation infrastructure like the Suez and Panama canals, both of which were built to handle smaller ships. Container ships also produce large amounts of greenhouse gases. In 2009, the largest 15 ships emitted as much greenhouse gas as 760 million cars, or about two cars for every American. And their size and distribution of weight can leave them vulnerable to capsizing or losing containers in rough seas, which have gotten worse as weather patterns change due to global warming, as recently reported on Marketplace.